Hey guys, and welcome to the Finished Work Eschatology vlog number 17, subtitling this week, Flee to the Mountains. I am in a different venue. That's because I'm coming to you today from the road. We're ministering in several stops in the Midwest, and this particular day I am in Anderson, Missouri, ministered last night in Pineville, and will be in Springfield, Missouri the next two nights. And so I'm taking a few minutes, though, to get us caught up together on our journey in Matthew 24. It brings us to the 16th verse. I want to read through the 20th verse today. Hopefully we can cover that ground. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house. And let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. But woe to those who are pregnant, and to those who are nursing babies in those days. And pray that your flight not be in winter or on the Sabbath. The Jewish historian Josephus tells us that the first general that did the attack against Jerusalem was Cestius Gaius. And Gaius attacked the walls for 5 days. Josephus even commented that had he just pushed, he could have went into the city, and that it was inexplicable why he did not push. And then on page 204 of his History of the Jews, Josephus writes, or from his Jewish Wars rather, he writes, he retired from the city without any reason in the world. So Josephus was confused why Gaius would go to the edge, fight for 5 days, and then without any foreseeable reason, no explainable reason, he would retire from the walls and then go away from Jerusalem. And what happened is the Jews opened the gates and chased General Gaius and killed 5,300 Romans. It appears that as if they had turned the tide in the war. And then Josephus writes this on page 206. He says, and then many of the eminent Jews swam away from the city as from a ship when it was going to sink. Now, interestingly enough, I want you to remember that Josephus is a Jewish historian. He is not a Christian. And so he explains things as he sees them, but he doesn't always put a spiritual slant to them because he doesn't have a spiritual slant. He couldn't figure out why Gaius didn't attack the city. He was amazed to see all of those fleeing the city as if they knew that it was going to get worse. That's odd, because they had just won a great victory killing 5,300 Romans. Why would they leave the city if they had just won a battle? There was no indication they were going to lose this war. And yet, Josephus reports that they came out, and these are his words, like people fleeing from a sinking ship. I'll come back to that in a second. I want to comment about Eusebius. Why Eusebius is such an important character for us in our historical study is because Eusebius has the only surviving written account of church history in its first 300 years. He's a third century writer, writing about the events in the early church. He's our oldest surviving account, and so we should pay attention to some of the things that we read when he wrote them. I want to read to you from Eusebius's History of the Church. This is from page 111. He says this, furthermore, the members of the Jerusalem church, now, the Jerusalem church would be Christians, of course, by means of an oracle given by revelation to acceptable persons there, were ordered to leave the city before the war began and settle in a town in Perea called Pella. To Pella, those who believed in Christ migrated from Jerusalem, and as if holy men had utterly abandoned the royal metropolis of the Jews and the entire Jewish land, the judgment of God at last overtook them for their abominable crimes against Christ and his apostles, completely blotting out that wicked generation from among men. Now, this is a third century church historian who writes that they had received as if an oracle, a revelation. What was that oracle? What was that revelation? It was Matthew 24. It was a writing that was already becoming popular among Christians. It was the knowledge that Jesus had said, when you see the abomination of desolation at the holy place, flee to the mountains of Judea. So I believe that when they saw Gaius and his approach and a five-day assault on the walls, and then Gaius inexplicably moves away from Jerusalem, and there is an attack by the people in Jerusalem, they run out and kill 5,300 Romans, The Christians inside of the walls don't take it as, oh, we're going to win the war. They take it as Jesus said, get out. Get out now. And that's exactly what we're going to do. Let me read to you another. This is from John Gill's 1852 exposition of the New Testament. This is his writing in regards to Matthew 24:16, when Jesus said to flee to the mountains. And the reason that I wanted to tell you about the year it was published, 1852, this is less than 20 years after a very popular message begins to grow in the Western church world called dispensationalism, or a futurist view of prophecy. And so a guy like John Gill was just responding to some of the new dispensational teachings in his exposition. Listen to what he says, reading from his commentary on Matthew 24. It is remarked by several interpreters, and which Josephus takes notice of which with surprise, that Cestius Gaius, having advanced with his army to Jerusalem and besieged it, on a sudden, without any cause, raised the siege and withdrew his army, when the city might have easily been taken, by which means a signal was made and an opportunity given to the Christians to make their escape, which they accordingly did, and went over to Jordan, as Eusebius says, to a place called Pella, so that when Titus came, now this is the next Roman general, so when Titus came a few months later, there was not a Christian in the city. So it sounds like the Christians took Jesus' words very seriously for their generation, that when they saw the armies come passing Jerusalem, get out. Let's reread this, the next few verses in the sequence, because I want you to see that Jesus gives some very detailed instructions to those fleeing that don't have anything to do with you and me today. Verse 17, let him who's on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house. Let's deal with them one at a time. Let's deal with that one first. The tone and tenor of verses 17 through 20 is, make haste, don't waste any time. Jesus is very clear, don't go backwards, don't go back into houses. If you're in the field, stay in the field. If you're on the roof, stay on the roof. That stay on the roof part doesn't make a lot of sense to us because, A, none of us are on our roof unless we're roofing our house. We're up there, it's not for a good reason. But in their day, this would have made a lot of sense to them because, again, they are who he's talking to. They spent a lot of time on the roof. The roof was another room in the house because they were flat roofs, and they would go out for warmth or for cool because they had harsh winters and tough summers, a lot like some people do today. And so the roofs were flat, but the houses were so close to adjoining that a lot of the roofs would even have walkways, or they were close enough to jump off to the next roof. And so Jesus says, if you're on the rooftop when you see the armies, don't even bother to go down into your house. So the city of Jerusalem was laid out to where you could jump from one roof to the next roof. You could go rooftop to rooftop, just running along. You see Hollywood will do things like this in James Bond movies or something, where he's on the roof and they run, jump onto the next roof. It's always overseas in those buildings, or it's in the metropolis in the U.S. where the tops of the commercial buildings are flat. Well, the homes were that way. So Jesus says, if you're on the roof, don't even bother to go into your house. You need to get out of the city now. So the roofs were designed, you could be in the middle of the city and jump house to house and make your way all the way to the gates and escape. So it must have been very severe. Jesus is telling them there's going to be a window of opportunity. Don't waste it. Don't miss it. Verse 18, let him who's in the field not even go back to get his clothes. So if a man is in the field, he sees the city get compassed about with armies. He said, don't even bother to go back into the city. You're probably not going to be able to get in anyhow. But even if they open the gates, don't go back. Just flee. Get away. Again, there is a sense of haste. There is a sense of not wasting time. And this was a very familiar theme to the Jews. Remember, in Genesis, they have the story of the burning destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And Lot is told by the angel, flee the city because justice, judgment is coming. Flee. And when you leave, he says, don't look behind. In fact, Genesis 19 would be worth your looking at sometime. I'm going to take you to Luke in a moment. But Genesis 19:17, read that verse where the angel says, escape from the city. Don't look behind you. Escape to the mountains. Okay, so the Jewish history already has this idea that if attack is coming, we escape to the mountains. And so the Christians remember Jesus saying that in Matthew 24. But I want to show you something from Luke 17 in regards to that. Just a moment. Luke chapter 17 and verses 29 and 30. Let's read 28. Likewise, as it was also in the days of Lot, they ate, they drank, they brought, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built. But on the day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. Even so will it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. Listen to verse 31. In that day, he who's on the housetop and his goods are in the house, don't let him come down to take them away. Likewise, the one who's in the field, let him not turn back. Remember Lot's wife. Now, did you catch that? This is a parallel thought to Matthew 24 here in Luke 17, where Jesus takes the Sodom and Gomorrah disaster and he appropriately places it within the time frame of that generation that he's talking to and says, think about what happened in Sodom. I told Lot not to go back. I told him not to turn around. In fact, remember Lot's wife. She looked back. She turned to a pillar of salt. And so the message, I want to slow down here for just a second and say this properly. We've all done sermons. I have. I don't want to put anybody else in there. I've done sermons where I would say things like, you know, don't ever look back. Don't look back on your past. Don't look back on your problems. Don't look back on where you failed or where you missed God. Because if you look back, then like Lot's wife, you could turn to a pillar of salt. And we'll spiritualize the salt on what it means and why it's so bad to turn to a pillar of salt. And I'm not mocking it. I'm not cutting it down, but it's so contextually out of place. The reason Jesus said, remember Lot's wife, is because this statement is not to be spiritualized. It's eschatological. It was prophetic. He said, look, Lot's wife looked back, turned to a pillar of salt. If you look back, if you hang back in Jerusalem when these armies can pass it, you're going to die like Lot's wife. It's not Jesus saying, I'm going to turn to a bunch of pillars of salt. He's saying, you're not going to make it. You don't have anything in Jerusalem to look back to. So remember, Lot's wife is an eschatological prop. It's a statement of their pending future. And he says, you don't have time to go back. You don't have purpose to go back. You don't have a reason to go back. So honestly, to preach a sermon now or teach remember Lot's wife and put Christians under condemnation because they look at yesterday is contextually irresponsible, to say the least. Now, is there any truth in not looking back? Well, there could be in some situations, but hey, if you don't look back and see what happened in your life, you're probably going to be ill-equipped to move forward to know how to change things and know what to do. So I never really liked it. I always thought it was pretty, something wasn't right about the interpretation. And now I see that what Jesus was saying was, remember what happened then, it's going to happen again. All right, now we go back to Matthew 24, and we've been working our way through those little verses, 16, 17, 18, short, quick little verses. But look at 19. But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days. And there's an exclamation point here. Jesus says, woe to the woman that's pregnant and nursing a baby. Why? Because if they're fleeing from Jerusalem into the mountains, if you're pregnant or nursing a baby, it's going to be quite difficult. The journey was difficult enough if you're trying to flee for your life, but it's certainly going to be difficult, Jesus says, if you're pregnant or if you're nursing. And pray that your flight, this is verse 20, pray that your flight maybe not in winter or on the Sabbath. One of the first things I want to point out here is that Jesus does not know when the day of vengeance is going to happen. All he knows, all the Father has shown him, is that it's going to happen to that generation. But he doesn't know if it's going to happen in the winter or the summer. He doesn't know if it's going to happen on a Thursday, a Friday, a Saturday, a Sunday. He doesn't know. He says, pray that it doesn't happen in the winter. Pray that it doesn't happen on the Sabbath. I'm going to talk about why. But before you do, just remember that Jesus is tipping his hand here. He does not know the day or the hour. He does not know the exact moment when that vengeance is going to occur. He's just giving the things prophetically as he's received them from his Father, but his Father didn't tell him every single thing. So he says, pray that it not be in winter. Because if you were fleeing Jerusalem in the winter, you would have to face the elements, You would have short days and long nights. And of course, the cold could be overwhelming in the mountains. You wouldn't be able wouldn't be as easy to heat and take care of yourself as you would in your own home. So Jesus says, let's pray that doesn't happen because it's going to be rough. And then he says, and pray that your flight be not on the Sabbath. A couple of things about that, and then I'm going to share a story. Looking back, it's quite humorous, but at the same time, it's problematic. The Sabbath day was not all that applicable to Christians. You notice in the book of Acts that they're meeting on the Lord's Day. They almost as if they chose the Lord's Day to differentiate themselves from the Jews, who were observers of Saturday Sabbath. And so Jesus says, pray that your flight be not in Sabbath, because remember, every Christian that in the early days that would have been living in Jerusalem, 99% of them would have been Jewish believers. They were Jews first, then they were Christians. And so when they fleed out of Jerusalem, a lot of them were still carrying with them Jewish traditions, the Sabbath being one of them. And so Jews had travel restrictions on the Sabbath. In fact, the rabbis had given a 2,000-foot travel restriction on the Sabbath, which is not even a half a mile that you could journey on the Sabbath. So that's not enough to get to the mountains of Judea. And so Jesus says, pray it be not on the Sabbath. But also, many times, the cities in Judea would close their gates on the Sabbath so that there was mandatory travel restrictions. So Jesus is saying to Christians, pray it doesn't happen on the Sabbath because they're going to close the gates of the city and you're going to want to get out. So pray that that does not occur on Sabbath. Now, the story I told you I wanted to relate that's humorous but also a little bit sad. I was on the radio years ago daily, at some points 5, 6, 7 days a week. And I was on several stations in the Midwest. I was on a pretty big station in a big city in the South. I won't say where. And I got a call one day from the radio station, one of the DJs, I think it was a DJ or maybe one of the managers, and he had been listening to my program, and he said, I have a question for you, and he said, I can't get anybody to answer it. He said, I'm really starting to wonder if we shouldn't be Sabbath observers under the new covenant. Now, you got to understand, this was before I really understood a whole lot about grace or the finished work, but I still wasn't a Saturday Sabbath Christian. And I'm still not. Your Sabbath is Jesus. If you want to observe a day, go ahead. And he used Matthew 24:20. He said, why would Jesus say, pray your flight be not on the Sabbath, if the Sabbath wasn't an important day for us? And I remember at the time, because I was still a dispensationalist, I still saw Matthew 24 as in our future, not just the disciples' future. And I really didn't know what to say. I thought, well, it is kind of odd that Jesus emphasizes the Sabbath. And so it's kind of humorous that the interpretation of that verse would be used to argue pro-Sabbath. But looking back, I know now why Jesus says it, because he's speaking to them, not to us. But it also shows me this. If our eschatology is wrong, if we mess stuff like Matthew 24 up, we actually open ourselves up to all kinds of strange doctrines. Because here was someone who was willing to argue for Saturday Sabbath based upon misunderstanding an eschatological phrase in Matthew 24:20. I want to give one more scriptural support. I look at my time and I'm running down. I do try to keep these in a certain time frame so it's easy for everyone to listen and view. One more thing. Go if you turn there, at least if you jot these down. Luke chapter 19, verse 43. Jesus says, for the days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment around you, surround you and close you in on every side, and level you and your children within you to the ground, and they will not leave in you one stone upon another, because you did not know the time of your visitation. So if you do not pay attention, Jesus said, to the things that I'm telling you, they're going to surround you on every side. So the motivation for the Christians in Jerusalem was they knew that the abomination of desolation standing in the holy place was going to surround Jerusalem, and if they waited, they would be leveled. So as Josephus said, they flee Jerusalem like people swimming away from a sinking ship. Next week, we have now advanced through the 20th verse. We move on to verse 21 next week. I want to deal with at least two things. Next week, we're going to talk about the 144,000 Jews, from the book of Revelation, the 144,000. We're going to talk about what that means, and I think we're going to show you where I think that falls in the time frame. And we're going to deal with Great Tribulation, because that's the next verse in Matthew chapter 24. I hope to see you next week. God bless you.